You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick. This episode of the Sketchnote Army Podcast is brought to you by the Sketchnote Idea Book, the sketchbook designed for sketchnoters. Equipped with a no-bleed, no-show-through paper, the Sketchnote Idea Book can take almost any marker or pen you can throw at it. Learn more at sketchnoteideabook.com. And now, on with the show. Hello, friends. I know right now we're in a very challenging time in the world, with the coronavirus pandemic happening, and it can be very distressing. I wanted to mention a few things we've created here that can maybe offer a little respite and a moment of joy amidst all these challenging days we find ourselves in. First, for something to listen to while you're at home or wherever you may be, we built up a collection of over 50 Sketchnote Army podcast interviews over 6 seasons, and you can listen to those anytime you like at sketchnotearmy.com/podcast. Secondly, we have the Sketchnote Army Slack, something we've been emphasizing recently. It's an online chat tool, and it's a place that we've created where you can chat with other visual thinkers about sketchnotes, visual thinking, or whatever's on your mind. We've even got a self-care channel there if you need to talk about some things to help yourself out. You can join the Sketchnote Army Slack for free at sketchnotearmy.com/slack. Please sign up for the Slack channel, and we'll talk to you there. Thanks. Hey all, it's Mike, and in this episode, I talk with Ole Kvist Sorensen, a visual facilitator, a co-author of the book Visual Collaboration, and founder of Bigger Picture Academy. Hear us talk about our paths into visualization and how we both use visuals to help make better sense of the world. Enjoy. Hey everyone, this is Mike Rohde, and I'm with my friend Ole Kvist Sorensen, who's on the line with me. Ole, how are you doing?
Thank you, Mike. Very well. I am right now sitting in my home in Paris, where I've been for half a year in a new environment, but with the same work that I've done for, I guess, 20 years. But I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it's really great to have you. We've sort of come across each other through social media channels, I think, specifically LinkedIn. Your book specifically caught my eye, and then we just started having these discussions, and it just seemed so natural to have you on the Sketchnote Army podcast. As some regular listeners will know, my goal in this podcast is always to sort of push the edges a little bit and start looking for people that aren't necessarily right in the middle of the community, but to start to move the edges out so we can keep growing and expanding. So you seem like a natural fit, so I'm so glad that you're on the show. So thanks for making time.
Thank you.
So to get started, I always like to begin with context. I think context is so valuable to understand a discussion. So what I'd like to do is have you describe who you are, what you do, and then how you got into this visual thinking business, as it were.
Yeah. Well, the easy parts are I'm a 47-year-old Danish guy who have been brought up in a country of 5 million people speaking Danish, but with a group around me, that be my parents and my grandparents, who were always encouraging questions. And some part of my family were always very creative and very visual. And with that foundation, I've spent my life going, in a way, through traditional education, but always eager to seek boundaries, ask questions, and explore possibilities just on those boundaries. And that has led me to an education that has been very different from the normal road people would take, but encouraged by family and friends, take that path anyway. And that was an education called Chaos Pilots, which was an entrepreneurial education. And they decided at the school to take, and this is when I'm around 23, 25, between 23 and 25 years old, to put an outpost from a Scandinavian education, land in the middle of California in San Francisco, and spend a year there. So part of what I think the reason for this podcast is 1 year of amplified work and curiosity in Silicon Valley that then led me towards the visual community that has been founded from my view in California with David Sibbett as one of the pioneers, and then a handful of other people from that area, MG Taylor as well. And that led me to here's something where I am, well, I'm visual and they work visually and you can make a living on this. And that was in 1996. And then that took off in a more directed, let's say, career. So that's the shortest version I can give of a background for being here.
Interesting. And so I know David Sibbett being, you know, heavily involved in graphic recording, graphic facilitation. Would that be the discipline that you would say you've been trained in, or is it a different discipline? I don't want to assume specifically where you came from or what you would call what you do. How would you describe what you do?
I think I was always as a kid the one who was drawing a little bit, and I made posters mm-hmm. to impress the girls who I wanted to have attention. So I made posters like showing my ideas or my way of thinking. And then in gymnasium, and when I was 15 to 18, I used visualization in my exams to show the entire history of the Greek history, or of the math, and I used visualization as a way of expression, but it was when I landed in California that it became a field. And then I would say since 1996, then I've been seeing myself as a visual facilitator, and much of the visual language has been inspired by The Grove and David Sibbett, but also by the work of Day Gray and Sonny Brown. And then I stumbled across your book and I saw that there's another angle to it, which is I see it as a more personal angle to the more in front of a crowd facilitation angle. And we can talk more about that. But I would call myself a visual facilitator. And then today it's blended with a background in organizational learning and adult learning. And that has led to a methodology about visual collaboration that we are then now out with in a book.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. I like the broadness of the term visual facilitator, because I think it leaves you open and not so pigeonholed to one thing specifically, which is pretty interesting. You mentioned all those people, all great people, and I have a connection with Dave Gray as well. Sonny Brown's a friend. I haven't met David Sibbett yet, but he's on my list of people I'd love to meet and talk with. So it's really interesting to see how all these fields are all in some ways coming to a point together, and that there's a lot more visualization happening, I think, at least from what I perceive, and it's more accepted in some way. It's very interesting to see as a kid that you were using this visualization as part of your personality, and you've been able to maintain it and continue it and then turn it into something that you use for business, which is, again, something Dave Gray, David Sibbett, I'm doing the same thing in my role. Pretty fascinating that you're out there, and we have only just recently connected with each other, but I'm excited about it. And specifically, you mentioned, you know, the new book you've got, Visual Collaboration, that I would love to talk about a little bit more as well in the work that you do. But maybe to give us a little bit more detail, as far as visual facilitation, what would that encompass for you specifically? How would you describe kind of the daily work that you do with companies and individuals?
So fast forward to the last couple of years, it has been, I would actually like to ask you back of how you started, because I think one of the things that I've seen, and I'm guessing that the audience of your podcast, like many people have been visual, but in school or in education or in work, there wasn't really that space to be visual. But when we do courses in bigger picture, it's like many people come and say, finally, I have now a place where this visual language I've always had really can come to life. And there wasn't a space for it, but it seems that it's being more included in different work styles. And I really find that I have a strength here that I can bring on board. I always drew as a child, or I started as an engineer, I always put my mind up on the blackboard. And I always love the way presenters or educators, trainers, they came in and they used the blackboard or the whiteboard or surfaces to explain themselves. And that seems to be a little bit of a common denominator. And what's happening right now is a lot more of those kinds of that way of working is being amplified or being cultivated by many different threads. And design thinking or scribing or visual facilitation, graphic recording or art, those are all converging into, as I see it, spaces where you collaborate differently, and therefore, what has been your angle into this? Because I think we come from two different threads, but there are so many of them now that it's like it's interesting to see how they are emerging and what the different threads contribute to each other.
Mm, yeah. So my background is I drew as a child as well. Somehow managed to maintain it through school, even though, you know, many students have the experience of having it sort of beaten out of them somewhere, either by because it's not cool to do or the teachers told them not to. I think I found a way to make it valuable and useful for the people around me. And so that was my way of holding on to those skills. And then as I got into university, continued to use that that tool. And then my training was as a graphic designer. So as core to what I did, visualizing ideas either for clients or for myself was really valuable and almost necessary. I was a little bit unique at the time when I came through because I was right after the desktop revolution. So there was lots of movement towards computerization of design, which I was, you know, excited about. But I also found this way to blend the analog part of it. So in other words, doing lots of sketches and showing concepts long before we started going into the computer. So I've always had this feeling of trying to hold back the computer as long as possible because I feel like there's still details that need to be worked out visually. And it's so much quicker than going to the computer and making use of that. And I just have an opinion, too, that I think when you go into software, you tend to form your ideas around what the software developers let you achieve. And I think when you hold that off longer, as long as possible, you start to imagine ideas that maybe the software can't achieve, but may still be valid. And then maybe the software needs to be modified or you need something else to achieve it. So my opinion has always been to try and sketch as long as you can and only switch to computer when it's really necessary. So that was my mindset going in, and I just kept on using that visualization technique in my everyday work. It was only for clients and for myself or colleagues. And then around 2007, I just was frustrated with specifically note-taking and how I had somehow fallen into this trap of feeling like I had to write everything without imagery and capture everything almost like a court reporter, and felt really burdened by that late 2006. And as a designer, I'm often faced with limitations. So I decided to put some limitations on myself. I went to a conference early in that year, and I took a small notebook and a pen, which were the opposite of what I had before. I had a large notebook and a pencil because I thought I could, you know, have the ability to erase mistakes. The problem was with writing everything down and using pencil, it was such a forest of dense notes, I had no interest in going back and actually finding the value in those notes. So this sort of changed my whole perspective to suddenly had, and from my perspective, I had lots of free time to actually think about what was being said, to focus on really listening and analyzing in the moment, and then only putting down the things that seemed relevant or valuable or interesting. And then suddenly had all this free time to do things like lettering and drawing, and images started popping in my head because I had this space, and then I'd capture those. And it was actually sustainable and enjoyable, and the notes I could process pretty quickly, and I started having a sense that this was pretty valuable. And then other people started commenting that even the notes which I produced personally were valuable to them, and I'd never intended it that way. They were just for myself, and I realized that there could be some value in sharing these concepts. And then after I started doing it for a few years, discovered the whole thread of graphic facilitation, graphic recording existed, and it had been around for a while, and that the things that I just sort of stumbled onto through osmosis turned out to be common things that graphic facilitation and recording also did, just at a little bit more of a neutral space because, you know, you're doing it for somebody else. And that was about the time I took a course with Dave Gray and got introduced to his way of thinking. And the rest is sort of gone from there, just expanding sketchnoting. And, I think I use the term sketchnoting in a really general term. There's some people that are very specific about it being only doing live talks or something like that. And I've sort of expanded the definition quite a bit. In a lot of ways, what I've realized in retrospect is I'm sort of reteaching the education that I had in my college university days about design principles and how to capture images and think as a designer, and repackaging it as sketchnoting for people who had no such education. So it's really reteaching the things that I've learned and the way that I've found they work. But in a way, like, I'm always trying to stop short and provide them as principles and not as you must do it this way or that way, but here's the core principles, now apply these. And I think that's the benefit of that is people have been able to take those principles and do things that I could never have imagined, which is really, really fun and interesting to see how it's taken off because I've left it open, because I've made it available and not tried to define it too much. It's enough definition that you understand, but not so much that you're tied or limited to something, that you have the freedom to kind of express it in your own way, and that you don't have to be, I think my big message is you don't have to be a great artist to do the work, which is a really freeing concept for people once they really grasp that idea, because it really encourages them to just start. Because before they were limited, like you said, there was no space for it, or there was no, you know, the space for them might even have been their belief that they could do it. That could have been the lack of space as much as finding a place where it gets applied. So that would be a brief context of how I came into this world, and it would be interesting to hear how you reflect back, how that aligns with what you see and how that overlaps the work that you're doing.
A couple of thoughts. One is that I also had the experience of sitting and doing my notes, and I always visualize. So, and people beside me say, "Hey, could we have a copy of that, because that would be valuable for us as well." And that was in school settings, but it also became something at conferences. And the second thing is I know that I look forward to a podcast with David Sibbett, because he can tell you that in the cellar of his previous home, there's like a shelf space that you can't imagine of black notebooks. They're double size of the ones that I think, or actually the same size as the sketch note handbook. And there's just row after row after row after row of notebooks that he's taken throughout the years. And it's fascinating to see the way he does notes. Anyway, so I think I used big notebooks, you know, like twice the size of the sketch note handbook when I did Educate, because I had always this, and I think that's why we call our company Bigger Picture. We need everything on one page, you know, and I need bigger and larger posters. So I've been, like, the way we started our business, and I think that would be a hint to anybody who wants to start out there. If you're visual, you know, and if you like taking visual notes, you put up a huge piece of paper, or you take a whiteboard, you go to your preferred, or like really to die for, client, potential client, and you ask that was what we did. What are the five biggest challenges you face in your organization right now? And in half an hour, you draw out and sketch out those five things on one big piece of paper. And I went out to 10 of my father's network. He was in business, and he said, "Oh, go talk to these guys." And then I went into their meeting room, I put up my poster, and I said, "Okay, here, what are your five biggest challenges? And they talked, and I interviewed, asked a good chunk of questions, was very curious, and then noted and visualized as we went along. And then after the half hour or 45 minutes, it was like, okay, so what has happened now is I have visually facilitated, been your pen, to draw out your ideas on this big piece of paper. Do you like this?" Yeah. And half of them say, "Yes, please leave it. I want to show this to my senior group in the board, or I want to use this to show my project group." And then, okay, how much would you be willing to pay? So, and that was the business case. And the five others, they said, "No, not interesting. I don't like visuals, or that doesn't really compute. It's too sketchy." But that started the whole, you know, our company. And because people had the value of a person coming into the room, asking a couple of relevant questions, putting it up in a systems overview that helped them see the big picture. And that could help them in a very short amount of time give the essence to others. And so I think my background into this is like it's moving from the personal notes into shared notes for others where you're the one asking and visualizing, but constant in a constant feedback and with a very strong understanding of this is a sketch. It's just an out. It's something that's not finite. So you can take it and you can further work with it, and we can then polish it up later. And that has just, you know, moved into a company that does three things. One, we design, facilitate, and visually document moments of impact. And that can be a little interview. It can be a two-hour session with 10 people, or it can be 300 people for 3 days. And visually thinking through that, providing the visual scaffold or the learning arena for such an event, and visually then having output that goes further and can be used to communicate or continue work. That's sort of the one thing we do. And the second thing is anybody who wants to communicate something in 10 minutes, take it 50 slides or, you know, a supply chain process description into one picture, is that we help them through different meetings come up with one visual that can explain that story in a short term. And then the last thing is, and that's where I think your book is on our shelf of the top 10 books that people, you know, people should have, is help people. The last thing is training people to visual thinking, a little bit in the line of Dave Gray and what David Sivit also does, but also M.G. Taylor. You know, you don't need to be great at drawing, but you can just use these basic shapes. Then you can actually get your paper out on, your thinking out on paper. So those three things, and it starts with getting people to start sketchnoting or start just doing it on their own, because many feel intimidated by getting up on a big piece of paper. But once they've done it, done 20 pages of sketchnotes in their own notebook and have had the reaction, like you mentioned, like somebody say, hey, that's really cool. You're structured. It's well designed. There's something, not just words, and it's also drawing and maps and grids that show some relationship. That's really interesting. Could you do that next time? So I think that's to me, that's like visual facilitation is putting your thinking into visuals, but using it as a mirror or as a way to further a dialogue. And it's really bound in great questions that you can then ask, and together you can collaborate visually around an output that is then valuable for everybody who contributes to it.
Mm, that sounds a lot like there's a period of time a few years ago where I worked in an insurance company on a development team. And my role on the team was as a user experience designer, but naturally my visualizations leaked out, as they often do. And we eventually developed, every Monday, we would basically park ourselves in front of a wall-sized whiteboard. The development teams would come by with their features that they were going to add to the software that we were building. We would queue it up ahead of time, some, you know, little bit of research. And then typically I would be the one listening to the discussion, asking questions, and visualizing what the feature might look like. We might do two or three different options and then sort of pull the group, because developers, project managers, business analysts were all at the table. And they could all see it happening as it was being built and would ask questions, make comments. The best days were days when the developer or business analyst would walk up to the board and grab the marker and add something or make a note. And of course, as they spoke, I would document in a separate color any annotations around these visualizations. And those were really valuable for a couple of reasons. One, I think the collaborative nature, kind of what you're talking about, everyone was involved in the process. Additionally, I was the only designer on this team of like 50 people. So it also took me a little bit out of the process as a bottleneck, because afterwards we would take a photo of the whiteboard, post it in a shared space. And if a developer got to that before I did, they could go ahead and build it. And I would just simply come and collaborate with them to refine it from a user experience perspective. But that was really powerful. Mm. And I've continued to do that in the role that I'm in here a little bit less regularly, but, everyone who attends those seems to find those really attractive, because I think it really involves them and it gives them a voice. And ultimately, if they feel comfortable enough to begin visualization themselves, then it really drives it home all the way. And then they can start imagining places, the space, like you talked about, mm-hmm. finding space for it every day in the work that they do. Maybe not all the time, but they're not afraid of it. Mm. And when the whiteboard's there, they might just jump to it, which is really encouraging to me.
Yeah. I definitely often say that it's been a gift to continually work on a way that gets people excited for what we are creating. And then, you know, having a possibility of saying, well, I do make a living of visualization, but it's not just visualization. It's helping people see something, and it's helping themselves. Like at the moment, it's really become to help people discover their own visual language, and then stepping in the back a little bit, guiding people, because we've now been in this field for a long time. So I feel definitely see myself as a trainer who guides, moved into guiding people to figure out how they best themselves can visualize their thinking, and then all the kinds of tips and tricks that can help that happening. And I actually have a thought on the designer, because we've had, and I don't know if you've had that experience, but it's if you're a sketchnoter or if you're a design, you're illustrator, strong illustrator or a great designer, you know the tools, you know how to, your brain is visually wired, so it pops with ideas of how to take that abstract word and put it into a visualization. You know how to make it look good. And then we worked with designers and could feel a little bit like intimidated, because I'm not a good illustrator, but I can illustrate. I've always been considered, a little bit, but not that good. So it wasn't a career choice for me to be illustrator, designer, but it's always been a part of my luggage, my toolbox. So some of the companies we worked with, and we worked with IKEA, we worked with Maersk, we worked with Kraft Foods, IDEO, and we worked in teams that do innovation, supply chain, HR, communication. And in some of these companies, they have a very strong group of designers. And then they have a strong group of engineers, and maybe they have a strong group of educators and communicators, and they all have very different angles. But the designers are the ones who are considered, you're the guys, you're the team who can draw and visually depict, so that's what you do, and we'll just talk. But then we figured out that both the designers and the engineers, for example, they can meet in between their skills and get a very basic language. So that whenever the engineers try to explain their deep knowledge, the designers, the who are really sharp in the visualization and depicting ideas, they get a much better briefing and can take that and mold that into something that's really, you know, everybody's super happy about, that they then go and present to the board in order to get a new project approved or something like that. And therefore this I don't know if you've experienced that as a how do you step out of the role of the expert visual person into the guide of helping them find a common language that doesn't need to be super cool, because that's actually what you do in your book. You put it into a place where everybody can do it.
Yeah, I think I always feel I'm curious about other people's spaces, and I try to understand them as much as I can. And in some ways, I feel as though I'm sort of stepping into their language, because I think engineers maybe have a slightly different language or way of thinking. And I try to put myself in their position, in their perspective, and understand what they're coming at. And, the benefit I see is, having worked with lots of engineers, I start to understand their perspective and then can represent it in some ways, start to understand where they're coming from before they get there, so I can actually adapt and tailor the way that I approach them, the way that I draw the simplicity. But also it challenges me to better understand not only the possibilities of engineering, but also the limitations of engineering. And sometimes, you know, at a broad level, not specifically, like I would never say call myself, you know, a software developer, but I understand, having worked with them and heard what they're saying, what the limitations and what are the challenging type things. And also even just having the humility to say, just because to me it seems easy for you to do such a thing doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy. There's always some compounding factor behind the scenes that may make it much more complicated than it may seem on the surface. And that's why you have an engineer who can can work with those with that specific area because they know how to make it happen. So that was also a very good learning for me, was trying to remain humble and to listen to what, if I kept hearing something over and over again from a developer about how difficult a certain thing was, I would sort of lodge that away in my memory and remember. So when I came to something similar to that, I would ask them, so this seems to me like it maybe is an easy thing, but I don't want to make that assumption. Tell me whether that's right or not. And then they would have the opportunity, you know, to correct me or to maybe say, well, actually, this is actually easy, as easy as it seems, and because of this and such and such and so. And then I would try to remember those things. So a lot of it was trying to really understand and put myself in the other's shoes, empathy, really, ultimately, to understand. You know, and I think that just goes a long way. Same thing with business people or anyone else who you're working with, trying to understand their perspective puts you at a better advantage to at least making an effort to try and get closer to where they're coming from. And then it makes it a lot easier than to collaborate with them because they understand your attempt to do those things. I have a similar principle with when I travel internationally. I try to learn a few phrases in the local language at very least, so that I can approach someone and speak to them as close as I can in their language. As in a sense, it's like it's a way of honoring that I'm in your culture and I want to honor your culture. And even though I can only go maybe a couple of phrases, at least we've broken the ice. You know my intention and that I'm trying to be humble about it. And then you're a lot more welcoming and open. And it opens doors in a different way than had I come in and just demanded that they speak English, right? That's a different type of perspective. And I think that the same concept applies in these other languages, which are the language of engineering or the language of business or the language of what have you, science, to not just assume that mine is the only language and somehow mine is better than yours, but there are some things to be learned in these other languages that I can start to incorporate and at very least have empathy for it, if not understanding for it.
Yeah, but that's very important. That could be an easy trap to jump into. Definitely a couple of good examples of when that doesn't work if you're not really aware of what space you're landing in and what their viewpoint might be.
Yeah, I think it's valuable. And having had you discuss a little bit about sort of your perspective and how you started this business, I'm going to make the assumption, and you can correct me, that visual collaboration is probably capturing these principles of what you've just talked about in a book form, in an illustrated book form. Is that a pretty safe guess, or am I quite off in that estimation?
No, that is a very safe guess. I'm curious about your books, because talking about the book we've created, me and Laura Bostel, my business partner, it's been a long, you know, it's been a long journey, and it's really reflecting much of what we've already talked about, like the 15, 20 years I've really been into this as a professional. It's pulling all that into 300 pages. And since we started, it's because my background is adult learning and organizational learning. Already in the beginning, we had, let's teach somebody how to use this in their meetings, in their conferences, so anybody can benefit from being visual. So that was sort of, let's do that. And that was from year one. But 15 years later, we sat down and said, let's try to then, this is a method we now have. It's based on, we're standing on the shoulders of a handful of others. But we've moved this into, we think a little bit of a Northern European theoretical foundation, like how do we actually use this to create group learning, collective learning that's different than individual learning. The visuals really help from when you do individual notes to you do collective notes. That's a great artifact that shows, can be sort of a artifact that resembles what might be happening in the group that's not individual. So that is the book, and I can say a couple of things about the structure of the book, because it really builds up to the main message of why visual collaboration is relevant now and how it really can play a part to some of the bigger things that we are in organizations and families and in education we're struggling with. And I can talk for ages about that, but I could of course also just say a little bit about the building blocks of the book.
Yeah, maybe let's cover the highlights and the building blocks, and we'll let someone pick the book up so they can actually go deep and see the detail.
Yeah, well, I think looking at how many books have been published recently and also how the field is really growing, what we saw as something that would be a great add-on was a tree with a big crown of the field of visual facilitation, sketchnoting, design thinking, not design thinking that way, but scribing, all kinds of visual practices. But the trunk, could that be expanded a little bit to bring more to the crown? And so we said, let's figure out a very systematic, step-by-step approach that can get more people to see themselves as visual facilitators. Because when you see what you mean, and when you show others what you mean, and you collaborate around these big pictures, it does improve the conversation. It changes the way people enter a conversation when they see a sketch as something we all contribute to. So the building blocks we've then made, the five building blocks of visual collaboration, is one, step one, block one, is discover your visual language. So we are always out trying to get the innovation team to figure out what is their language when it's visual. What does it look like when they talk about agile, when they talk about an idea or innovation? Healthcare, what is the healthcare provider? What is the patient? What is the different kinds of processes you do in healthcare? So that's block one, because as we also talked about, many might have this hurdle to get over that I'm not a visual person. But then block one actually says, if you just do it like this, you can then also be visual. And the second block is use that visual language to envision any meeting, any conversation, any conference. Make a visualization of how the best possible journey of before, during, and after such a moment of impact looks like. Because then, like an athlete, you're much better equipped to actually do that thing, and you can do it much better when you have that thought through. And the third building block is then, now you have your visual language, you have your design, what are the questions that will really bring people on board to do the job of that meeting you just designed? And the magic of questions is you can pose questions that will unearth or that come up, help people come up with visual language that can help people talk again, like talk about both complex issues or challenging issues and so on. And the fourth building block is now when you have these questions and your visual design and your language, you can now create templates, structures that you can put on the wall that will help you go through that meeting with success. Because a template like the business model canvas is 9 questions that focuses a conversation about a business model, or a game plan, or an empathy map, or all the different kinds of templates that are out there. But you can make your own fitting specifically to your meeting or your conference, so that becomes a supportive structure for your collaboration. And the last building block is really, if you've made a great design for a meeting, you have a visual language to talk about that topic that you're having a moment of impact around, here's a playbook that you can draft a storyboard so others can actually take your design for, let's say, a 2-hour weekly meeting or evaluation meeting, and you can go out and scale that to many parts of the organization because you've visually shown how to do that. So we're training in that so people can go through it and have that experience that they're actually visual facilitators with a little bit of help. But then they can use that. And if with good questions and a good listening, you can then facilitate and involve other people of your meeting in putting stuff on the wall so you have that shared big picture that everybody has contributed to.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Just such a nice group of 5 ideas that really dovetail together and produce an output, I think, that should be attractive to sketchnoters who maybe are doing this stuff individually, but seek ways to bring it into the office and make use of it in an office setting or in any group setting, right? It doesn't have to be in a work setting. It could be in a group that you're part of. So that sounds really fascinating. Thanks for going over the high points of the book and now it's making me want to read the book. I haven't picked up a copy yet, but I think it's on the list, of course, and I can't wait to see. Because this is a challenge that I face at work, and I've found ways to make it happen with my own, and I think probably some of the things I'm doing probably align in many ways to the structure, but I don't think I've thought of it in that specific of a way, which would be really helpful to have a specific structure that we could start to follow and make use of from the book. So thanks. Thank you for doing that. This is super valuable for people who really want to make use of this approach.
Hopefully I think it adds. So in this bag that you have, everybody could have, where like mm-hmm. you do your sketch notes, you do your business model, you do your design thinking, and then you do you could have a visual collaboration element that would mm-hmm. It all fits very very well. I think the work environment where many are experiencing, people want to get together, have more out of their meetings, and be engaged and have an active role in co-creating something. Usually, and more meetings are based on a topic that it's unknown. We're seeking, right? We're mm-hmm. in so many different places. The change is showing up in the way that we have to get in and come up with solutions at a meeting. They're not given to us, and we can't rely on one person to have that answer, but it has to be co-created. So this is in my view definitely a way to say that we're in a place and time and organizations where we're stuck with some ways of working together. As you said, with technology, it doesn't really allow us to be completely free to do mm-hmm. what our minds and brain like or our capabilities. So we need new ways to collaborate, and here's one part. There's definitely a couple of contributions that brings in the visual and the analog visual in any physical meeting. And then, of course, we can talk more about digital tools are developing so that we can actually transfer that analog mm-hmm. into digital environments. But that's a whole different, that's a whole different new discussion. Frontier.
Well, I want to shift a little bit now that we've talked a little bit about philosophy in the book and the structure. Is a little more practical. I like to mix both theoretical and practical in the podcast. And I'm very curious to hear, what are your favorite tools to use? Are there any tools that you find so reliable and so pleasurable to use that you tend to go back to them, whether that's paper, pens, any kind of thing like that? And if you happen to use digital tools, are there any digital tools that you like that you might want to share with the listeners?
Okay, so that'll be a speed talk. So the first one is, a black Pilot pen. I don't know what you use, and a superb book with great paper that's blank. And I'm assuming that your new book that's just being shipped these days is what I'll love to have oceans of, and many of those I know. It's big enough, it can have the pages, and it feels nice because there's something about the niceness to it. So that's my personal note-taking book. It's so mm-hmm. that's the analog one. It's being really outcompeted or challenged by Remarkable, and then I have that in front of me. I have a Norwegian-produced black and white. It's like a Kindle, but you can draw on it. Do you know the Remarkable?
Yes, I think I've seen that quite a bit, and I'm very curious about it. It looks pretty interesting, but it's so hard when you see images of it. It doesn't quite translate to actually using one. So I've debated picking one up for testing. So it sounds like you quite like it.
Yeah. So I like it because, like with any book, you can have 20,000 books in a Kindle. You can have all your notes here and they're stored very well. It's just black and white. I'm really tired of the tablets that shine, and you're like the shininess and the very slippery surface. But mm-hmm. so that said, I have a Remarkable that I'm playing with in terms of organizing my notes. And any sketchnoting can go in there, but you just have black and gray and white on a white, white surface, and that's it. But it's really easy because it uploads to the cloud immediately. I can include it in any PowerPoint or any Word documents or any document, and therefore it's not lost. And of course, I have to have battery, but the battery is very long lasting. The pen is really nice. It's like paper. It's still, there is something about the physical notebook that technology will not, in the next coming years, will not outcompete. So I also have an iPad Pro, and drawing on different drawing, like I love the iPad and iPhone with the apps like Post-it Note app and the Scanner app, Scanner Pro app, and Sketchbook Pro. So those are great drawing tools, but I mostly use my phone and my tablet as devices where I synchronize, take photos, take Post-it Note with the Post-it Note app, and add that into a folder as Dropbox to share with the team or whoever we're working with. Mm-hmm. But ever since, so the last, when I went from note-taking, the first tablet PC from Fujitsu and Toshiba, like very thick ones, but they had a great pen mm-hmm. and they had Windows Journal. The moment they came to the market, and that's almost 12 years ago, we got them. And I think that made a huge difference because we were able to, we have a whole catalog of icons, templates, visual products that's all shared in one space. It's not lost in paper. And I think now over the last 2 or 3 years, the tools that are now with the tablet, the pens, the quality of the pens, you know, Whiteboard, Microsoft Whiteboard, Mural, Miro, a couple of those tools where you can actually go in and visually draw together or visually visually create stuff in Word, in PowerPoint, in Excel. All of that is just accelerating the use and showing that to regular business organizational employees that your tools are already there. All you need is to use the pen. Working visually, sketchnoting, you can do that already now in your programs. There's really not a big difference. Yes, you have a screen that might be a little bit slippery, but you know, because it's so glass surface, but you can actually do that. And then I've worked with the Google Jamboard and the Samsung whiteboard screen, and then the Surface Hub, Microsoft Surface Hub. Mm-hmm. And I think they're all getting closer to something, but it's still annoying because there's glitches and it takes time. Mm-hmm. And that fluidity of work collaboration just can't have too many irritation stops that because technology is not there yet. So it's always a give and take of how digital you can become.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely improvement could be done, and but I'm excited that there's movement, like you say, in all those spaces, and I'll have to look into the Remarkable. We'll of course put that in the show notes so people can check all those things out as listening to the podcast or after they've listened to the podcast. So, well, thank you, Ole. This has been really fascinating, a really interesting discussion. And I feel that I could probably go with you another hour, but I don't know if our listeners would stay. Maybe we'll have to have you come back and go in a little bit more detail or find another venue where we can discuss and collaborate in some way. I think that would be quite fun to spend some time with you and talk through these five steps and show how they work. And of course, pick up Visual Collaboration, which is available now. We'll of course have links in the show notes to that too. So thank you, Ole, for making time to be on the show. It's been just a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me. Can I say that anybody who goes to the site of the book, visualcollaboration.site, sends me an email on your show, I'll be happy to send them. We have 200 icons that could get everybody going about the basic shapes, or that we can put a link in at the podcast.
Yeah, we
can
so definitely
that people we'll can, link for can sure. get that. So anybody who wants it, I'll be happy to share some of that.
Oh, that's so generous of you. Thank you, Ole. And for everyone who's listening to the show, thanks for listening to another episode of the Sketchnote Army podcast. And until the next episode, this is Mike signing off. The Sketchnote Army podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and brought to you by Rohdesign Studios. It's produced and edited by Alec Polianis of Amp Creative Studios. The theme music was created by John Schiedemeyer. Special thanks to Chris Wilson for his hard work on show notes. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook. You can find the books on Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code RODY40 for 40% off. Please share this podcast with other visual thinking friends and be sure to leave a nice rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app so others can find the show.